Professor Joel Covell was professor of psychiatry and director of residency training at Yale College. He has a diploma in psychoanalysis from Downstate Medical Center Institute. He practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis for 24 years and left those professions in the 80s, partly out of dissatisfaction with the healthcare system. He had been professor of social studies at Bard College since 1988 until earlier this year. He is both a scholar and an activist, published over 9 books, over 100 articles and reviews on subjects including white racism, therapy, against the state of nuclear terror, about Nicaragua, one called Red Hunting in the Promised Land, and his book The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or The End of the World in 2002. He is editor-in-chief of the quarterly journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. He accompanied Pastors for Peace as they broke the U.S. blockade on Cuba in their 1994 Friends shipment. And in 1998, he was the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senator from New York. Joel Covell is more information at the website joelcovell.org. I'm John Grebe in today for Sharif Fam on This Week in Palestine. So I'd like to just start out by asking you, Joel Covell, would you tell us, in your words, what is Zionism?
Oh, okay. And thank you for asking me to be here. It's both a necessity and a pleasure for me to speak on this subject, and so I'm very happy to take part in this. For me, Zionism can have many meanings, but we have to focus on the main one, which is the ideology of a state which is for one people, the Jewish people, and there's two significant features of that. One is it purports to be a Jewish and democratic state, that is an ethnic state and democratic state, not a religious state at first, but ethnic. And the other is that it purports to be this kind of state for Jews all over the world, so that actually any person of Jewish extraction, which means having a Jewish mother or grandmother, is entitled to a citizenship in the state of Israel. And this is a very large claim, but it is one that plays a very important role in the history of the Jews in the last half century, and also, of course, because it's a state of one kind of person, which is to say not the indigenous people of Palestine, it also excludes these people and it gives them second-class human rights status and forbids their return. So every Jew in the world can return to a country, even if there's no evidence at all, as would be the case for me and the great majority of Jews, that his people ever lived there, and no Palestinian in the world can return to the country from which their people have been expelled by Zionist aggression. Zionism is forced to be aggressive, of course, because it makes a claim on somebody else's land and home, and if you want to take over somebody else's home, you've got to play rough, you've got to be tough and mean and unscrupulous and violent. So this is the course of Zionism, and it's had many tragic and horrific implications, and I think it's running its course. I think it's evolving. I think it's going in a direction that is still very, very horrific, very much a tissue of profound human rights violations, but at the same time shows certain possibilities of eventual transformation into an outcome that's worthy of human beings. In a summary, Zionism is the ideology that Israel is the state of the Jews and the fulfillment of the Jews, and it is, as a result, an aggressive and imperial ideology.
Joel Covell, would you tell us what was your experience being raised Jewish, and if and how you've broken with some of those traditions you were raised with?
Well, I was raised in the heart of the Jewish so-called diaspora, in Brooklyn, New York, and my family was conservative Jewish family, came from Russia, Ukraine in the early years of the last century. It was a very standard Jewish upbringing. It wasn't a standard family because there was a lot of dissension within my family. My parents disagree on everything, including Israel. My father being anti-Zionist from a conservative position. My mother being ardently pro-Zionist. But long before that became an issue, I was subjected to the Jewish educational process, and I never liked it. I was always a terrific student, loved learning, but I felt that what I was being taught was some kind of a, you know, tribal. I wouldn't have the word tribal, but some kind of, you know, restraining, confining way of looking at the world, and I never took very well to it. And there were other family conflicts which would take a long time to detail, but what happened basically is that by my mid-adolescent years, I decided I didn't really want any part of being Jewish in any kind of religious sense. And eventually, as the State of Israel showed its true colors, I decided I'd also don't identify with the Jews in an ethnic sense. I'm proud of so much that Jewish people have accomplished under terrifically difficult circumstances very often, but I'm certainly of the opinion that the only way for a Jewish person to be authentic as a human being, much less as, not so much as a Jew, but because it's authentic as a Jew, but as a human being, is to speak out against the crimes of his people, her people, and whether these people are Christian, Muslim, or whatever. My people happen to have been Jewish, and I think one has to speak out against that. And I'm what you might call a non-Jewish Jew. I don't have any particular attachment to the religion. I take part in the, you know, I'm a member of a cultural group, but I do so from a position of rather extreme rejection, shall we say, of its implications, insofar as these are Zionist.
Joel Covell, I wonder if you would tell us about how you see the significance of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and the partition in 1947 in terms of shaping what Israel is today, and with an eye toward whether you and other Jewish people did or did not choose to identify with those two crucial times in the 1900s when the State of Israel was defined.
Well, just to back up a second, the Zionist movement, as most people know, but just to get it clear, really emerged out of Eastern European, Central European Judaism in the last years of the 19th century. It was part of a sense of impending crisis in European civilization, and also part of a movement towards nationalism, which is a phase in our history, which hopefully we're getting over. But it was one of the possible alternatives to being Jewish. Most Jews were not Zionists. Zionism was a particularly specifically minority point of view, and it was really going nowhere, in part because it's a very extreme and audacious and immoral project, and most European Jews had no interest in going off to Palestine. Those who did had to adopt a particularly aggressive and ruthless strategy to overcome the huge difficulties, and one of the difficulties, of course, was weaknesses. There was no possible way of military or takeover at that time, and they had no strength to do more than occasionally buy a piece of land or that piece of land from the Ottomans who ruled it. But what they found they had to do, and this is key, is to ally themselves with an imperial power. And they looked for the Germans, they looked for the Turks, and they got nowhere. And eventually, through a very complex process, they managed to persuade Great Britain, who saw in them basically a useful instrument of European expansion into the Middle East, which was about to go to pieces because of, you know, the breakup of the traditional colonial world after the First World War. So the Balfour Declaration arose out of that with a lot of machinations and a lot of hypocrisy and bad felt faith and the like, and stated that the His Majesty's government views with favor the settlement of and the formation of a Jewish national state in historic Palestine, and then adding with typical British hypocrisy that we understand this should in no way prejudice the situation of the indigenous peoples there, which of course is just an utter lie. It had to do just that. It led to a very long, ambivalent, and complex, and eventually violent relationship between the Zionists and British imperialism, which after the Second World War became the object of Zionist terror tactics to drive them out, which they were eventually forced to do. But at the same time, the Zionists returning to the numero uno, the number one imperial patron, which would be, of course, ourselves. And that's the chief story today, is the formation of this relationship. It was principally crafted by President Truman because of his weakness, and the Zionists were leaping into the breach and giving him all kinds of support. He wasn't particularly fond of them. His diaries show outrage at a lot of what they were doing, but he was a politician, and this was his ticket to political, you know, durability. So he was just going to play the game, and that game consisted of engineering the United Nations conference in 1947 in such a way that the land of Palestine would be partitioned. This was not the intention of the Palestinians by and large, and it was certainly not even the intention of the U.S. State Department. They didn't want it because they knew it was going to create endless trouble with the Arabs. And it's not out of charitable impulses, you understand. The U.S. had decided that this was their prime strategic goal because of the centrality of automobile culture and our industrial system itself and its reliance on petroleum, and the fact that the petroleum of the world largely appeared in that part of the world. So big debate in U.S. ruling class circles as to whether to go with the Zionist side or the Arab side, and eventually that debate was settled on the Zionist side, much to the chagrin of a lot of people, even within the U.S. government. But that's the way it turned out. It led to this very long, turbulent, and thoroughly, bizarre relationship between the U.S. and Israel, which is playing out even now, but it's a long way from running down, but it's still undergoing a lot of crises, and I think it's eventually going to break down, but it's a long way off, and meantime we're caught up in the middle of it, and our struggle has to be, if we're interested in human rights, if we're interested in justice, if we're interested in true peace, our struggle has to be against both Zionism and against the kind of relationship that evolved between the State of Israel and our own U.S. government, the State of the United States. So that's, a little nutshell there, but the key thing is that Israel, the Zionist movement in general, felt it had to have an imperial patron, could never have succeeded, and will never succeed so long as it does not have an imperial patron, and therefore becomes part and parcel of the course of empire. And, there's a bitter irony here, because at the beginning it was considered a movement of liberation. It was a movement to escape Europe with its terrible legacy of anti-Semitism. And it did so, however, by joining Europe and joining up the imperial mission and the colonial mission of Europe.
Joel Covill, you put out a book in 2007 entitled Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Would you tell us a bit about what the release of that book was like? Part of the story is that the University of Michigan Press put out the book, agreed to put it out, and then after receiving an onslaught of what's described as right-wing criticism about the book, about the topic, and your treatment of it, the University of Michigan Press dropped the book from publishing it, and has apparently since resumed it. What was that story?
You've told a good part of it, and I'll just fill in some details. The book was published by Pluto Press, which is home of London, England, so it needed an American distributor. And Pluto has had a long-standing, well, a few years back, relationship with the University of Michigan Press, which had proceeded fairly smoothly. It's interesting, actually, the University of Michigan Press had put out another book, anti-Zionist book, on one-state solutions. So they were not by any means a Zionist organization. What they were was a typical liberal, academic press trying to, basically stay within the prescribed limits of political discourse. And my book went beyond those limits. It called for the one-state solution, but did so in a very, militant way, I suppose. But it's a scholarly book, and I challenge anybody to, dispute that. I always like to debate that book. But anyhow, it definitely went further than the usual book on this subject. And, the first response to anything that's subversive, and certainly anything that's subversive vis-a-vis Israel, is to just ignore it and make sure that nobody pays attention to it. And that indeed was the case of Overcoming Zionism. I lectured a lot, and it was good. I was getting involved with alternative media such as your own, and that was very good. And I was traveling to Europe, particularly the United Kingdom and Ireland, and that was very good. And so even though there was no no reviews, you couldn't get it in bookstores, the New York Public Library didn't carry it, it was months before it even got in the Library of Congress.
Even though there are plenty of books by Pluto Press and distributed by the University of Michigan Press the United States, this book, Overcoming Zionism, you're writing about this, and we should mention that you're a published author of 9 books.
Well, 10, actually. This is the 10th
book now.
Yeah.
And over 100 articles and reviews.
Yeah, I wrote a lot. I've written a lot.
On a variety of different topics.
Yeah, yeah.
Politics, yeah. Psychiatry, Nicaragua, yeah. Capitalism, socialism,
I've always been,
ecology. And you've been a professor of social studies at Bard College since 1988. So despite all this, your book did not receive any kind of wide reviews. We did review it on this radio station, I should mention, back closer to then. But you ran into this enormous storm of controversy, criticism, and complaints. What happened at Bard College with your professorship?
Well, let me get back to that. But I just want to say that what happened in 2007 was that the neglect and the, make it go away didn't work, and Pluto wrote me and said, boy, you know, your book is kind of catching on, and we keep selling copies even though nobody knows about it. It spreads through the structures of alternative media, and that's democratic communication. That's so important. You guys made it possible for that book to survive, you know, in a broader sense. But the result was that the Zionist lobby, I call them the Zionist thought police, realized that it wasn't going to go away through simple neglect, and they were very alarmed by it. And there's a group called Stand With Us. I'll get back to that in a moment. It's an important point here. Stand With Us, supported by the Wexner Foundation, $800 million. These guys have endless money, and they just started a campaign against it. Mostly internet broadsides and attacks on this press in Michigan, and the press folded. It was incredible. They just gave up and panicked and called my book hate the speech, and it doesn't deserve the rights of the human discourse, and so on and so forth. We were threatening a lawsuit with them, and they were going to lose it big time, so they backed off. But what they then did is break the contract with Pluto, which they could do. So I want to make sure people know that Pluto Press itself, which is a very respectable, although progressive and left-wing house, lost its contract because they couldn't destroy my book, and they decided that they wanted to destroy all of Pluto's books. But the final point of that is that they ended up destroying themselves, because after they lost the contract with Pluto Press and all this whole flack, people resigned from the University Press. The University of Michigan Press at present is more or less a wreck and a ruin, and it's a great university press that sort of went down itself over this controversy. And I think the lessons are very, very important. A lot of them can be learned on the website CODZ.org, Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism, which is really all we're trying to do is to get this subject out. And the, yes, I mean, the tense with my relationship to Bard is not, you know, I have been. I am no longer a professor at Bard. I was let go there early this year. They claim just for economic reasons and because my contract had expired. I wasn't a regular tenured professor, but I had been a, had an endowed chair. I'd been on the faculty for 21 years. I had, we argued, de facto tenure. I was a very senior person on the faculty, and I was just more or less summarily let go, and that led to another campaign. And
Joel Cavell, let me interrupt if I would, and ask you, what were you told by the establishment at Bard College, by the president of Bard College, by people with purview over your endowed chair and professorship at Bard College, about why, after all those years on the staff and faculty, and in an endowed chair for years, was it 7 years? You were let go.
No, it was about 12.
12. What were you told about why you were now being let go from Bard?
Well, it was in stages. In the first 10, I was at Bard for 21 years, and the first 10 years were actually very good. They were very supportive of my political interests. But what happened, both they moving to the right and me keeping going as a public intellectual. And then when I started, well, publishing also my book on eco-socialism called The Enemy of Nature, which is very radical. It calls for dismantling the capitalist system in order to save the planet from ecological breakdown. And they didn't want any part of that. And particularly the Zionist thing, because the American academic establishment is remarkably Zionist. I think we have to be very, very aware of that, and some schools more than others, Bard, and to a considerable degree, the president is virtually an official in the Israeli government. He travels there 10 times a year and the like, and he conducts the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. He's, you know, sort of conductor, musical conductor. And and the administration, you know, they said basically, well, we're going through this huge economic crunch. But the point was, they didn't sit me down and say, well, let's say, how can we work this out? I'm coming towards retirement age anyhow, and I wanted to work out an amicable settlement, which could have been, you know, satisfactory to all. But what I got was basically you know, a pink slip saying, you know, leave your badge at the door and, you know, good luck in your future endeavors. We don't want you anymore. And they started out by saying, well, they don't want you because of the financial requirements. But in order to justify that, they also had to say, well, you don't fit into our educational program. We have a different, you know, vision. And then they started talking about my teaching reports having declined, which was a very dubious proposition, I may say. And the whole process was handled in a very, shall we say, prejudicial manner. Again, you can read about that at CODZ.org with considerable detail. But
Joel Cavell, how long after your book was published did you get this pink slip from Bard College?
Oh, well, the book was published in 07, and so this pink slip was in, you know, early February of this year. So it's almost 2 years. But it's remarkable that when the book was banned by the University of Michigan Press, Bard College, which is a self-proclaimed advocate of, you know, human rights and freedom of speech, did absolutely nothing to protest it. I mean, it is amazing. I got 600 letters from people all around the world protesting it to the University of Michigan, but not one from the Bard administration. And that was a good sign to me that they were obviously in tacit agreement with what was happening to that book. And then other signs and such, which would take us too far afield now, use up the time we have left, so I won't go into it. But the, you know, it's this long, slow process. I lost my academic chair, which is named after the Alger Hiss, which is the chair on the left, showing that Bard itself was on the left in the early years. I lost that academic chair after I published articles advocating a single state solution and deeply critical of Zionism. Almost, you know, like a few weeks after these articles came out, I was told I no longer had a chair. There again, it was that, oh, well, the family, the Al-Jahis family, is not happy with us. You single person having the chair is too political. We want to make the chair more cultural, et cetera, et cetera. But it was all tied in with my activism and my militancy on this subject.
Let me ask you about that and to delve into your book a little bit, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. An interesting comment, a review for the book, Samir Amin, director of the Third World Forum, writes that your book is absolutely fundamental for those who reject the unfortunate confusion between Jews, Judaism, Zionism, and the State of Israel, a confusion which is the basis for systematic manipulation by essentially an imperialist power, the United States, I believe he's talking about, and convincingly argues in favor of a single secular state for Israelis and Palestinians as the only democratic solution for the region. Those are the words of Samir Amin writing.
They're very helpful words, I must say. I'm very grateful to him for that.
This is a solution, as it's often called, or a strategy that receives very little attention in the United States, at least in the press in the United States, but it is a subject of wide discussion in political circles. Instead of the discussion that's always had in the U.S. media in the main, the two-state solution, the idea of one state to exist, secular, non-religious, not a Jewish state, not a Muslim state, and a democratic state. Tell us about why you think that's the most viable solution.
Yes, I'd be very glad to. I also would say that there's been movement on this front also, and your Boston region is a very active center of conflict and contestation, and a number of very strong right-wing Zionist organizations and repressive instruments have been coming out of Boston, Brookline, you know, places like Camera and the David Project and all that. But at the same time, Boston was the site in March this year, the first national conference on a single state. It was at, you know, it was at UMass Boston, and 500 people showed up. It was a tremendous event, and I would say very definitely that Boston was a major, you know, it's like a forum and a very advanced place, and you should be very proud of what Boston has done in this respect.
And thanks for acknowledging all of that academic discussion that does and can and has happened in Boston and to University of Massachusetts at Boston,
right,
which hosted that conference,
yes,
notably.
Yes.
But Joel Covell, particularly about a one-state solution and why a secular and democratic state?
Absolutely. Thoughts about this run roughly as follows. The one-state solution is not a blueprint. It's not something that I have a game plan for. You do this, you do that. Because fundamentally, it has to be worked out by the people on the ground. It's not for, you know, some expert at a distance giving his views on the subject. But it is, however, the logical and inevitable unfolding of a basic point of view, which is that our highest principle should be universal human rights. I don't think that any progress, anything good in this world can take place outside of that context and framework. And universal human rights means, of course, democracy in the political sphere. And we understand how much that is abused in the practice there. Other means, of course, socialism in the economic sphere and the like. But that's the foundational notion, is that every person, however different he, she may be, you know, individually, has a certain unique characteristic of being human, which gives him or her an equivalent right to the goods of the earth. And so you take an entity such as Zionism, which proposes that there's a state that is for one portion of humanity, and then also says that can be a democratic state. That's totally illogical, of course, self-contradictory, and leads to all these terrible outcomes. But the only way out of it is to propose a state that's grounded in universal human rights. And a state that's grounded in universal human rights cannot be the state for any ethnic group, cannot be the state for any religious group, and nor even any national group, but certainly not the former, not ethnicity. And national group's a little harder to define. But it can't be the state for the Jews. And so it has to be a state for all of the people within it, and it cannot be an ethnic state. So that's the point about the single state solution, is it has to be secular, because it can't advance any religious view over any other, and has to be democratic because it has to be grounded in universal human rights. That's what I call a strategic goal. It's the goal towards which we move. It's not an empty ideal, but it's a very real ideal, but it's something we have to realize in the world. And you realize it through various practices that are consistent with the universal human rights. And these include nonviolent practices. So it also, universal human rights also includes a notion of nonviolence. And out of that emerges a militant nonviolent struggle against the notion of a Jewish state. And the so-called two-state solution preserves the Israeli or Jewish state in its essence, positioning it alongside of a Palestinian state. This is not consistent with universal human rights.
Joel Cavill, let me just ask you at that point, because a lot of listeners, especially Americans, who constantly hear a kind of a line of reasoning by the U.S. State Department and others, will wonder. Of course, this idea of a one state solution, secular and democratic state, flies in the face of all this history Americans have heard for decades about Jewish people having been oppressed, marginalized, thrown out of countries, victimized, and blamed. A very small percentage of the U.S. population, around 3%, a small population of the world population, who want their own state to protect themselves and their own interests from that kind of persecution, which has happened throughout history, being surrounded by Arab and mostly Muslim countries in the area of Jerusalem currently. How could one state, secular and democratic, work under those conditions?
Well, conditions have to be. The notion of a universal human right and the one state solution is the political framework within which you work to transform those conditions. I mean, the whole thing is based upon the idea that history is not the aimless repetition of things, that it has a certain goal in it, and that there are things we can do to make the world better, such as, you know, abolishing slavery. He used to say this about slavery. I mean, how could the United States work without slavery, or women's rights, or whatever? There are many ideas that have been thrown into the dustbin of history, as they say, because they do not meet the needs of humanity as a living, growing organism. And you cannot simply blindly accept the given. You have to work to transform the given. And the amazing thing is that people around the world are increasingly taking this attitude with respect to the single state. I mean, I know we don't have much time left, but I could point out really how the state of Israel itself is headed for a disastrous crack-up, in my view. It's riven with tremendous internal contradictions. The criminality of its ruling classes and its governmental, high governmental officials is phenomenal. It increasingly acts with impunity and extreme violence. The whole nightmare of the Gaza invasion and massacre is an example of that. But what's happening around the world is that this state, which is very aberrant, shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's a terrible idea. Is now being deeply questioned, and it's starting to be questioned on a universal, worldwide plane. And it cannot be questioned unless you get down to the fundamentals of what that state is. Namely, it's an ethnic state that, you know, expends racism and dominates the indigenous population without a regard for their basic human rights. So you have to hold that standard to the Zionist state. And what's happening is that the Zionist state is becoming increasingly illegitimate and is being subjected to tremendous campaigns of boycotting, divestment, sanctions, which are taking place around the world. Whole countries of Brazil, like Turkey, in the UK, have been turning away from Israel. Israel is in deep, deep straits. And this is a very active process. This is a process of historical transformation. It's not something you can just sort of sit back and say, oh my God, nothing ever changes. Things are changing before our eyes. And the question is, we have to work to be part of that change. And the only way you can be part of that change in a beneficial way, in my opinion, but also in the opinion of increasingly large numbers of people, is to say, you must overcome Zionism. You must say that, you know, this is a very bad idea. It was a bad idea for the Jewish people as well as for everybody else, and its time is passing. And I think that's happening around the world.
Joel Coville, in the studio with us is Ken Barney.
Oh, hi. Good friend of mine.
A friend of yours and also a local activist around Palestine Solidarity since about 2002, who's had a previous career in teaching and counseling and psychology and social sciences, having worked in the mental health industry. And I want to welcome Ken to the program. Ken has his own questions for you.
Sure.
Hi, Joel. How you doing?
Greetings. Good morning.
Okay. Hey, listen, there's not a whole lot of time and too much to talk about, but maybe you could say a word about some of these more recent developments, the huge thing that happened with the publishing of Mearsheimer and Waltz work, you know, very recently, the Goldstone Report.
What do you mean, what happened with what the work signified?
Well, I mean, you know, with respect to this wall of ideology that we're fighting here, you know, the appearance of Mearsheimer and Waltz's book, you know, was a big, you know, very important event.
Right.
And you recently reviewed this.
Yes, right.
You wrote a really excellent review. I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the importance of the Mearsheimer and Waltz critique of the lobby. And then also there's, you know, the Goldstone Report now recently.
Oh, yeah.
and the Moyers interview. And the,
right. Well, I'm glad you bring it down to that level, because we sometimes can get lost in these abstractions, but they're fought out on the ground over these very, you know, real developments. Do you want me to respond at this point? Do you want to add to that question?
Well, no. However you want to talk about
sure.
that, maybe also even mention something about that Jon Stewart show recently.
Right. Well, that's okay. That's a bit much too. All right. Listen, Mearsheimer and Waltz represent a rebellion within ruling elites of the United States. They represent something called the realist school of foreign policy, as against the neoconservative school of foreign policy. They represent an effort within U.S. elites, because they're very, very mainstream, influential academics at Harvard and Chicago, U.S. and Chicago. To say that Zionism and the Israeli lobby have headed U.S. policy in the wrong direction, and that specifically, I think the turning point for them was the Iraq War and the whole Bush administration. People don't quite appreciate that the neocons in the U.S. government that took such tremendous control of U.S. foreign policy during the Bush administration, were, if not universally Jewish, there were many of them were Jewish, but the more important point is that they were universally Zionist, and the Zionist ideology entered the inner circles of the U.S. Foreign policy establishment in a way that had never been the case before. And if you look at a better book than Mearsheim and Wolff, a book by Jonathan Cook of the U.K., Z Press, called Israel and the Clash of Civilizations, you'll see how instrumental Israel and its lobbies were in fomenting the Iraq War. Not that the U.S. didn't want it, but the point is that the U.S. who wanted it was also very deeply embedded in this kind of Zionist worldview. So what they were doing, Mearsheim and Wolff, was trying to break up the hegemonic power of the Israeli lobbies. And that's a very good thing, and they took a lot of flack from it, and I think that they, on the whole, handled themselves very well, and they're part of this process that I was trying to talk about earlier, namely that with the passage of time, the notion of Zionism becomes increasingly question and dispute, and no more bizarre and real sense than from the Israel lobbies, which basically determine U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. Congress. I think it's one of the most shocking developments in the entire history of the United States is to have our congressional and also executive branches so deeply under the influence of an essentially foreign power, although it's a foreign power that also is deeply embedded within our own, you know, inner structures. So it's not a simplistic way of looking at things, and I'm advancing here. In any event, so I think Mearsheim and Wolff did a good thing. But I also feel it's necessary to go well beyond their position, because their position still was, first of all, embedded in U.S. foreign policy, namely the realist sort. I think, you know, it's just a question of different means to the same end, which is U.S. strategic control over the petroleum reserves of the world and the U.S. The full spectrum dominance over everything. With a more, you know, legal and liberally acceptable veneer. And more to the point, they felt that the lobby related to Israel as though Israel was like, or should relate to Israel as though Israel would be like a normal country, and you should just treat Israel, you know, like any other country. Well, of course, I think you should treat Israel like any other countries, but you should also recognize that the reason Israel is not treated as like any other country is that there are things about Israel that are very, very troubling and highly dangerous to the world in a way that Mearsheim and Wolff just simply either do not recognize or do not treat of in their book. You know, because they never they don't really discuss the Israeli nuclear armaments. They don't discuss the some of the aggressive and violent acts that Israel took. Israel was always a cat's paw of U.S. Imperial policy in South Africa, in Iran, in when the Shah was in power, and certainly throughout Central America. All these things are indications that you're not just dealing with an ordinary country here. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he spoke to the UN a few weeks ago, said, you know, we're not a normal country. But, well, he's right. They're not a normal country. It's a very dangerous, nihilistic country. And Mearsheim and Wolff sort of bend over backwards to try to normalize Israel in their book. They say, we're pro-Israel. We want Israel to be a healthier country. Well, Israel can't be a healthier country so long as it has the ruling Zionist ideology of being a Jewish state. And that's my point and contribution. The Mearsheimer and Wolff people say, in effect, well, you know, well-meaning Jewish Americans got carried away and built this lobby that gives unfair advantages to Israel in the, in the court of, the U.S. public opinion. They don't say that that AIPAC, which is the central organization, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is actually an illegal organization. They don't say that the Israeli lobby is illegal, which it is. And they know it is, but they don't. They try to sort of normalize it. How is it illegal? There's a law on the books called the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. It's been on the books since the 30s. It's been revised, but basically it says that if an organization is a representative of a foreign power in the United States, it has to register with the U.S. Treasury Department, and specifically with the FBI. And it has to make its books and records accessible to the Treasury Department and the Foreign Service and State Department, whatever, you know. It's a very definite law that's on the books that you're not supposed to simply allow an agent of a foreign power to have, a free hand. Well, the whole point about the Israeli lobby is that the an agent of a foreign power, namely the Israeli lobby, has a free hand. And not only has a free hand, it controls great chunks of the U.S. Congress. You can't possibly, at this moment, just given the...
All right, Joel, you chose to use the word controls.
Yeah.
Controls. Great chunks of the U.S. Congress. Be more specific.
The leap ahead, you're talking about the Goldstone Report, which is the issue of the day right now, because Richard Goldstone, South African jurist.
All right, Joel, I got to interrupt you.
Yeah, what's that?
You know it's a hot topic, Zionism.
Yes.
You use the word control. There's lots of stereotypes about Jewish people in control in the world, in the United States, of power. You talked about the U.S. Congress. Tell me then, who in the U.S. Congress does AIPAC control?
In the U.S. Congress, okay, in the House of Representatives, saying that the United States should reject the Goldstone Report. And Gary Ackerman and Berman represent. There's a number of representatives who have put that resolution up in the U.S. Congress. Okay, to say that the Goldstone Report is fallacious and should be rejected out of hand by the U.S. Now that is an extraordinary statement. Why should the U.S. Congress get involved in a report on the behavior of a foreign country, namely Israel? It is a foreign country. Okay, what? You see the U.S. Congress taking a stand about, you know, Burma, or saying that, that they're not being fairly treated. Why should the U.S. Congress make this kind of claim that we in the United States should override the U.N.'s judicial processes, which were to investigate war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza earlier this year? The U.S. Congress is promoting that, all right? That's control. There's no end of these kinds of...
Joel Coville, I just want to have an informed discussion. And when you use a word like control, I got to call you out on it and have you give examples if you're going to support it. Now, I think there are other examples. For example, the way that Representative Cynthia McKinney was... virtually run out of office by having her opposition candidate funded from organizations out of her own state, from her own state, so much that she then was voted out of office after having been a congressperson.
And I may add that happened twice, which is a world record, I suppose. And there are others. I've spoken to my local representative, his name is Maurice Hinchy, and he'll corroborate that.
Perhaps influence is a more balanced word, and a term that's there's tons of evidence for. In fact, AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee's own mission is to have influence over the U.S. Congress.
Well, which it does, but if it actually leads the U.S. Congress, just take this, get back to the Goldstone Report, which is very important, to out of hand reject the Goldstone Report. That's more. We're playing with words here, but we can say either influence or very, very strong influence or remarkable influence or control. The point is, U.S. Congress is doing something which does not reflect the United States itself so much as the foreign power of the State of Israel, which is somehow elevated into an object of its sympathy and concern. I think this is an extraordinary development. I think it, we can use the word control, you can use the word influence. It is beyond the bounds of normal congressional behavior.
So just for listeners who may not have heard of it, just briefly, the Goldstone Report by this very eminent, respected, longtime judge, Judge Goldstone, who happens to be Jewish himself.
And himself is Zionist.
From South Africa. He's been asked over the years to study and investigate and produce reports on a number of different political situations around the world, on human rights abuses in South Africa, in the Balkans, and this time in Israel-Palestine. He did so, having been asked by the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and produced his report. He himself insisted on investigating, now this was particularly the scope of it, was the recent war attack, mainly by Israel, against the Gaza Strip in Palestine, as claimed by Israel, four attacks by Hamas over the years, over a number of years, rocket attacks into southern Jerusalem. As it turned out, we always have to mention this in cases of such extreme disproportionality, that there were about 100 Palestinian deaths, civilian deaths, for every one Israeli death in this counting and including all of the deaths from Hamas rocket attacks, which amounted to very few, 1 in 100 compared to the number of Palestinian civilians killed. If we look at the number of wounded, it's more like 1,000 to 1 ratio. That incredible, overwhelming dominance by the Israeli military over whatever these allegedly Hamas, some of them not Hamas, rocket attacks into southern Israel, into this one portion of southern Israel, amounted to. Judge Goldstone produced this report. It's out. It's being discussed. It's just recently out. It's recently, as Ken Barney mentioned, being discussed by the prominent and longtime venerable journalist Bill Moyers on PBS, probably one of the best broadcast news program on broadcast television, Bill Moyers Journal, currently. And I know you saw that interview. I've talked with Ken about it recently. It's an interesting case in which Bill Moyers, with a tremendous amount of respect as a journalist, felt very obviously quite compelled to vigorously question, if not undermine, every single proposition the Goldstone Report made. It didn't have time to go into everyone, really, too much detail, but every underlying basis for the idea of an eminent judge to examine in a balanced way that military action by Israel. And he talked about human rights violations and the disproportionality of it. What's your sense about that, about the Goldstone Report?
And Moyers, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I have to say, I did not actually witness the broadcast, but I've read a lot about it. I've read sort of transcripts here and there. I can't speak for Moyers. I don't know what the man was thinking. I know that to a very great extent, so-called public broadcasting in America is not genuinely open, because it's largely controlled by foundations, and
I mean largely funded by foundations.
I'm sorry, I don't mean controlled. Funded by foundations, that's correct. And without such funding, it would just disappear, because it doesn't get, you know, taxpayer control. Why not use this word control? Taxpayer funding. And any event, there has been over the years an increasingly tight regulation of foundation supports, particularly around this subject of Israel. And it happened about 5 or 6 years ago that the Ford Foundation was making, I'm trying to remember exactly the context. I think it was some kind of intervention about the Congress on racism. I'm not remembering this point of it, but you can look this up. But there was a big storm about all this, and as a result, there was a declaration and a tacit understanding on broad fronts of the U.S. Philanthropic institutions that they would not support anything that was critical, that expressed severe criticism or fundamental criticism of the state of Israel. And that, that's out there. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact name of it, but it's a very definite phenomenon, okay? And I would speculate, and this is mere speculation because I don't know more Israeli and I don't know what's going on there, that there is a presumption that you cannot allow a program on public broadcasting in the United States, NPR, PBS, to go over the line of very kind of tepid mainstream understanding of what happens in Israel and Palestine. And I think empirically, that's the case. You can, no matter where you look in American public broadcasting, you'll see that's the case. And it's not the case, of course, for smaller, independent, community-based stations such as your own, where you allow somebody like me on. And we can have a discussion of these things, and I can speak my mind, and I can take questions from people, and people can disagree with me and the like. But this, to me, is a democratic forum. Public broadcasting, in the larger sense, NPR, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and PBS, all those complex bureaucratic apparatuses are very highly constrained and controlled. And as much as the corporate networks, where you don't get anything along the lines of decent coverage of a phenomenon like the Goldstone Report, or the whole Gaza business is extensively and exhaustively shown to be a tissue of human rights violations. And whatever Hamas did in terms of launching rockets, which is certainly not a good thing, it is a violation. There was a ceasefire last year, for instance, that lasted from July to November 4th, which is our election day, in which Hamas no longer was launching those rockets, and that ceasefire was being very effectively run. And then Israel violated that ceasefire, attacked Gaza, killed, I believe, 8 Hamas combatants, and upon which Hamas then resumed firing those rockets. And then, having resumed firing those rockets, Israel then used that as a pretext for its nightmarish assault on Gaza. So,
Joel Cavill, thank you very much for joining us today. And I want to let listeners know they can find out more about your work and your recent book, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. It is out from Pluto Press and University of Michigan Books distributing it.
No more University of Michigan distributor. It's distributed by Palgrave Macmillan. Pluto now has another distributor.
Thank you for correcting me. Distributed by Palgrave Macmillan. The book is Overcoming Zionism, and Joel Cavill's website, you can find out more information about the book, Joel Cavill, and his work and writing at joelcavill.org. Joel Cavill, sorry.
No,
let me give the spelling because people may not know how to spell the last name. It's K-O-V-E-L, joelcavill.org.
One word.
Joel Cavill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Very interesting discussion.